Matter of State versus Samuel Ryan. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
James K. Smith, Jr., Assistant Deputy Public Defender, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Samuel Ryan.
Morning. Lana Well, Corrector, Criminal and Youth Justice Clinic, on behalf of Amicus, ACLU of New Jersey.
Good morning. Dylan McGuire, Pashman, Stein, Walter Hayden, on behalf of Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers in New Jersey.
Morning, Your Honors. Deputy Attorney General Daniel A. Finkelstein on behalf of the state.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Smith, please go ahead.
Your Honors, with the permission of the court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for possible rebuttal.
That's fine.
Okay. If I may please the court, if I may begin today, I'd like to start with a historical perspective. The three strikes law
became... Could you keep your voice up?
I'm sorry. The three strikes law became effective in June of 1995. It has no age restrictions whatsoever, either in the original version or the current version. So theoretically, it could be applied to even where all three strikes were for offenses committed by a juvenile. Indeed, at the time the three strikes law was initially enacted, 14-year-olds could be waived up to adult court. So theoretically, it wasn't until 2016 that the age of waiver was raised to 15-year-olds. So theoretically, as originally enacted, the three strikes law would allow a 14-year-old who committed three first-degree crimes and was convicted on prior and separate occasions to be sentenced to life without parole. I think that the Attorney General would agree with me that now, under the decisions in Graham versus Florida and State versus Zuber, a juvenile offender, an offender could not receive life without parole if the third strike was for an offense committed as a juvenile. The issue, however, before this court is whether a sentence of life without parole can be imposed on an offender where the first offense, or even the first and second offenses, were committed as a juvenile. The bottom line in my argument is that prior offenses committed by a juvenile are not the equivalent of prior offenses committed by an adult, and therefore should not be considered as strikes under the three strikes law. My argument is based upon the well-settled decisions of the Supreme Court in the United States that, quote, children are constitutionally different from adults for purposes of sentencing. Supreme Court said that in Miller versus Alabama. They repeated it in Montgomery versus Louisiana. And this court in Zuber quoted it twice. The state takes the position that the fact that the defendant was 16 years old at the time of the first strike is irrelevant. Now, of course, it is not irrelevant in the sense that without that conviction, Mr. Ryan could not be sentenced to life without parole. However, the trial court took the position, and I think the Attorney General now reflects that position, that while he committed his second and third strikes as an adult, so therefore he should be treated as an adult. And in theory, I agree with that, that the second and third strikes were for first-degree crimes, that because of those offenses, he is subject to a mandatory extended term under the Graves Act, which would be somewhere between 20 years and life imprisonment with a mandatory parole disqualifier. The issue, however, is whether he should receive a sentence of life without parole based upon, and based in part upon something that he did as a 16-year-old.
Mr. Smith, are you making any argument whether or not a juvenile conviction can be used for an extended term sentence? Forget about three strikes.
Well, the only other extended term sentence in New Jersey is the persistent offender statute.
No, I'm talking about the Graves Act extended term.
No, I'm not getting into that one.
Okay.
The Graves Act, just for clarification, the Graves Act, the second offender under the Graves Act, says that the offender must be at least 18 at the time that he or she is sentenced. But I have not made any arguments whatsoever relating to the Graves Act. My argument deals entirely with the three strikes law.
But just to follow up on that, wouldn't the argument you're making today apply also to the Graves Act?
Well, if it ended up, but you know, again, that I haven't briefed that, and
but I mean, there's really no distinction between the two arguments you're making, assuming that the Graves Act ends up with a significant extended term.
I don't see one, but again, this is not an issue that's before the court at this time.
Are you making a comparison? You made a little reference to this in your brief, making a comparison to uncounseled prior convictions, which cannot be used to enhance a sentence.
Right.
You cited United States versus Bryant, but we also have, as you probably know, State versus Lorick and State versus Patel in drunk driving cases, then uncounseled conviction cannot be used to enhance a custodial sentence. And that's based upon some sense that an uncounseled conviction doesn't have sufficient indicia of reliability for at least enhancement purposes. Are you making a similar argument with respect to these juvenile convictions based upon Miller and Zuber and the other Supreme Court cases that at least for enhancement purposes, the strike should not be used?
Exactly. And I would say that, that you know, I sort of addressed this in my appellate division brief where the state's, reply brief, excuse me, where the state's, you know, argument was basically you don't even have a case here. You know, this is, you have no claim because he was sentenced for the third strike. You have no right to attack whatever happened on the first strike, but that's
how that came into play. Does your argument then extend even one step further to say that these juvenile offenses for which the defendant was waived up cannot be counted for any recidivist purpose?
No. I mean,
What line do you draw?
Well, this court has said, and the appellate division has said over the years, that offenses that are committed while a person is a juvenile can still be considered as part of their prior criminal history. And certainly, if Samuel Ryan goes back and is resentenced, as I said, as a second Graves Act offender, in determining the length of that sentence, the judge could certainly consider the fact that, you know, Mr. Ryan had this other conviction as a juvenile. I'm not trying to bar it from judge's consideration. I'm just saying it can't be used to impose a mandatory sentence.
A mandatory life. What is his potential sentence? If we did not include the juvenile as a strike for three strikes, for the three convictions, what is his potential sentence?
Well, his potential sentence is anywhere between 20 years and life imprisonment with a parole. This is pre-NERA, 1996, so it would be a parole disqualifier of up to 50% of whatever sentence the judge imposed.
Tell me if I'm mistaken. For his second conviction, he got 60 over 20?
Right.
That was for number two, without even considering number three.
Right. Now, in terms of addressing the issue of whether prior convictions for offenses committed as a juvenile are the equivalent of ones committed as an adult, the fact is that As I said, the Supreme Court has clearly recognized that these are different. You know, I have this language in Graham versus Florida that from a moral standpoint, it would be misguided to equate the failings of a minor with those of an adult. And they go on to say that a juvenile's transgressions are, quote, not as morally reprehensible as those of an adult. And it even says in Graham that criminal procedure laws that fail to take defendants' youthfulness into account at all would be flawed. So I am arguing that it would be improper to simply ignore the fact that Samuel Ryan was a juvenile at the time of his first offense, and that's exactly what the three strikes law does. Now,
Mr. Smith, you're raising a constitutional challenge, which takes us to the three-part test, and I wonder if you could address the third question, the penological objectives that are traditionally considered. In this case, by definition, we're dealing with someone who is a recidivist, who has recently committed a very serious offense. How does the issue of incapacitation in these circumstances fit into your argument?
Well, one of the main arguments or positions taken by the Supreme Court, of course, is that juveniles are much more likely to be rehabilitated than adult offenders. And that doesn't necessarily take place the day they turn 18 or the day that they enter into prison. It is a process. But the fact is that there is a likelihood that juveniles will be rehabilitated at some point, and that opportunity should not be denied to Mr. Ryan just simply because he...
So you went to rehabilitation, and I wanted to hear your thoughts on that as well. But focus first on incapacitation. You have someone who appears in front of the court as an adult, having committed a third offense as an adult that's very serious. Is incapacitation under those circumstances a legitimate concern?
No, because the purpose of incapacitation is based upon the premise that the person can't be rehabilitated, that they can't be released from prison, so you've got to lock them up basically forever to keep them away from society. So
address the argument that by the time one has reached the third offense, the person should know better.
Well, certainly they should know better. But what we're dealing with in real life here is a situation where there are a lot of juveniles who commit a crime, commit another, sometimes commit whole series of crimes.
The second two strikes were right there. He was 23. He was no longer a juvenile. Does that militate against your argument about rehabilitation of juveniles? Because he's now an adult, twice committing crimes twice as an adult, no longer as a juvenile.
Actually,
it's a real rehabilitation argument then, not as strong as you suggest?
Actually, he was 22.
22, 23. He's an adult. I thought it was 23, but perhaps I'm wrong.
Well, the fact is, of course, as I said, that what acts a juvenile commits sometimes bleed over to when they are adults. But the fact is that this is, I would say, not the type of hardened criminal that the legislature was thinking about when they enacted the three strikes law. They're not talking about a juvenile who commits a couple offenses and then commits a third offense after he becomes an adult. They're talking about the guy who commits one crime, he's locked up in prison for 10 years, commits a second crime, he's locked up again, and, excuse me, and then he commits still a third crime and gets life without parole. You know, this whole statute was based upon, as this court noted in the Oliver opinion and the Livingston opinion, was based upon the killing of a little girl in California by the name of Polly Klass. And turned out that the guy who killed her had spent almost all of his life in prison, and he got out and he did this horrible, horrible crime. And therefore, a bunch of states, including New Jersey, enacted three strikes laws. But the concern, I believe, was not that we wanted to lock up juvenile offenders who keep committing crimes, even once they become adults, but the hardened criminals who have devoted their life to criminality.
You spoke about incapacitation should not be a factor, but aren't we really assessing the length of incapacitation?
Sure.
Because in this particular case,
exactly,
given his age, he's not going to be eligible for parole until he's served 47 years, and he's 70 years old. I mean, so
right.
In considering whether or not a juvenile conviction should be used, and considering what we've said about the juvenile mind and Miller, Zuber, and other cases, the question is whether or not incapacitation of 47 years somehow is consistent with our constitutional norms.
Right. I think there's plenty of incapacitation in this particular case. And for all we know, if he goes back to get resentence, he could get a consecutive term that will keep him well into the age of being elderly. But that remains to be seen. Now, the state, in their brief, makes the argument that, well, this was, and I've sort of discussed this a little bit, this was a policy on the part of the legislature. And I would say, as I discussed before, the statute would allow, as it's written, a life without parole sentence, even if all three strikes were for a juvenile, and even if they were, you know, committed by a 14-year-old, that the first step in looking at, you know, what is the legislature's intent, of course, is the language of the statute, which, of course, is silent on the age of the offender. The second step, of course, is to look at the legislative history. I mentioned that there's language in both Oliver and Livingston about the Polly Class case and the national reaction to that. And none of that addresses the issue of strikes as a juvenile. I cited in my brief former Governor Whitman's press release in which he said that this statute was aimed at hardened criminals. Again, there's absolutely nothing in any of this that would indicate that there's a legislative policy that this statute should extend to strikes committed by a juvenile. In fact, as I said, it's somewhat inconsistent with the entire legislative scheme of the code, which precludes extended terms under the Persistent Offender Act.
I want to be clear in my mind in terms of your argument. You're not arguing that this statute does not permit what the trial court did in this case, are you? I mean, the language on its face does not distinguish between a juvenile waived up and convicted as an adult and adult convictions.
That's true.
Okay, so your argument, I thought, was a constitutional one.
It is a constitutional one.
And as a suggestion, the policy arguments that you raise can certainly be raised in front of the legislature, which would be free to change this statute. I think you need to focus, for the purposes of this argument, on why this statute is unconstitutional, looking at the test that the court ordinarily looks to. Please go ahead.
Well, let me move on then to the concerns that this court had in State versus Zuber, which I think are reflected clearly in this particular case. First of all, you have a question that this is a life without parole statute, that certainly Samuel Ryan received what was the practical equivalent of life without parole. Second of all, it's a mandatory statute, meaning that at the time that he was sentenced, the judge was absolutely precluded from considering the fact that he was a juvenile at the time of the first offense. In fact, the judge couldn't even really consider aggravating and mitigating factors. They would have been irrelevant. The judge was required to impose a sentence of life without parole without any consideration of Mr. Ryan's age or family circumstances at the time of the first offense. And third, of course, that this statute, as applied to a person who was a juvenile, at least at the time of one or two of the strikes, denies the offender the possibility of future release based upon demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation. Doesn't matter how well Mr. Ryan has done in prison, how many courses he's taken, how many certificates he's obtained, none of that matters. He's locked up at least until life 70. Now, so I think that, you know, one of the goals of any criminal statute, of course, is to, as we agreed before, to incapacitate serious offenders, which this Mr. Ryan does not get a free pass. He still gets resentenced, the second offender under the Graves Act. But rehabilitation, of course, is also a consideration that we have to ask ourselves, what is the penological goal of continuing to incarcerate Mr. Ryan for the rest of his life, based in part upon something he did as a juvenile, when in all likelihood, like many other long-term offenders, that he has been rehabilitated? I would conclude, if I may, with language from Graham versus Florida, which I'll paraphrase a little bit. If a juvenile offender is less culpable than an adult offender and less deserving of the most severe punishments, then it would be misguided to equate the failings of a minor with those of an adult, which is exactly what the three strikes law does. It says that there is no difference between a crime committed by a juvenile and a crime committed as an adult. I would say that that is not only misguided, it's unconstitutional under our state constitution, and I would ask this court to rule accordingly.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
Ms. Wolf.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to highlight a few main points, but also attempt to answer some of the questions raised. And if you're not able to hear me, please let me know. I've never been accused of not being loud enough, so I'm happy to project as much as I can with the mask, if that's all right with your honors.
If you're comfortable, you're welcome to take the mask off during the argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. In this case, but for the offenses that Samuel Ryan committed when he was 16 years old, he would not have received a sentence of mandatory life without parole. A mandatory scheme like the one in question here, which demands the imposition of life without the possibility of parole based on a non-homicide act committed as a child, runs afoul of the framework set out in Graham, Miller, and Zuber. The questions that Your Honor have already asked center around the Eighth Amendment jurisprudence and how that connects to the case here. The Eighth Amendment looks at three different factors, as Your Honor had already asked. The first factor is whether the punishment for the crime conforms with contemporary standards of decency. The second is whether the punishment grossly is disproportionate to the offense. And the third, as was just discussed, was whether the punishment goes beyond what is necessary to accomplish any legitimate penological purpose. In this court, recently in Zuber, you've afforded greater protection in the context of the Eighth Amendment to youth sentencing. So too here should this court find that using a predicate offense that was committed as a juvenile when the person was under 18 cannot be used to impose a mandatory sentence of life without parole. To your question, Justice Alvin, about other sentencing schemes, this is different here because it involves life without parole. And our Supreme Court of the United States and this court has found that there is a clear line around life without parole that makes that different from other sentencing schemes that have been raised, such as the Graves Act or other repetitive schemes.
But Ms. Wolf, let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Smith. He's not being sentenced for his juvenile offense. His juvenile offense is being considered as part of his recidivist history. Now he's being sentenced for not the second or first of his adult-oriented offenses, but the second one committed 3 weeks after. So it's not a spree. These are two separate adult offenses committed after he had already spent time in prison. So how far does your argument go? Are you suggesting that any mandatory use of recidivistic characteristics of a juvenile offense cannot be used by this court under the Eighth Amendment?
Justice Lavecchia, that's not what we're suggesting for today. We are not suggesting that any mandatory scheme for today's argument would be unconstitutional. That may be an argument at a later date in reference to youth. Our youth sentencing law obviously is evolving and only really has become so robust in the last 15 years. But for today's purpose, what we are saying is that a predicate offense that was committed as a juvenile cannot be later used to impose a mandatory sentence of life without parole. And that's the clear distinction here, because although he is technically past the jurisdictional post into adulthood by the time of his third offense, but for the offense that happened when he was a juvenile, he would not be facing this sentence.
That may be an enlightened philosophy for the legislature to adopt, but how does it pass the first prong of the Eighth Amendment test?
Our understanding of what is appropriate in youth sentencing is based on years of developmental science that really, since 2005, well after the three strikes law was adopted, has really become much more robust. And so our understanding of what happens in the mind of someone really who's under the age of 26, but we'll stick with under 18 for today's purposes, really has evolved a lot since the enactment of this law.
But what case law, what national consensus or consensus anywhere can you point to pass the first prong of the test for cruel and unusual punishment?
What we can look at here is our case law in New Jersey. We can look at Zuber. We can look at recent case law that talks about the effects of the impact of the developmental science on our understanding of the youth's mind. And so for some to say that an offense that happened before someone reached the age of 18 can be used to count against them and then impose a mandatory sentence of life without parole, when we know that young people who commit offenses are less culpable, that they have less awareness of and appreciation of the consequences of their actions. Knowing everything we know about the youth brain at that age makes the sentence of later mandatory life without parole unconstitutional, because they were not fully formed at the time that they committed that offense. And really, in this case, it's even more unique, because the facts of this case for Mr. Ryan show that he was under 18, he was 16 at the time of the first offense, and then for the second and third offense, he was still, although we're not making the argument that, you know, you should not count under 26, but in this framework, it's really important to look at his case as a whole, because his second and third strikes were also falling under the developmental science that we know of that says that he was not fully formed. So although it's not a spree under the law, as you suggested, or as you said it was not, here we really
it's not a spree. It doesn't count as a spree under our existing three strikes jurisprudence, does it?
It does not count as a spree, but it's important to look at the second and third strikes, because when you're looking at the framework as a whole and looking at how to analyze why this does not comport with our standards, why this is not constitutional, it's important to look at what was happening in his brain at the time of the offense. And if you look at the first offense, which we can clearly demarcate as a juvenile offense that he committed before he was 18, and then you say within several years later, he committed two offenses which were 2 weeks apart, and he was still under the scientific age of 26, which now we know the legislature has deemed important at sentencing because of the new factor 14 in mitigation. Looking at that as a whole, it makes it even less, under the first factor of the Eighth Amendment, makes it even more questionable as to why we would allow this offense to count as a predicate for a mandatory, and that's important, a mandatory life without parole sentence. The judge here has no discretion to impose any kind of individualized consideration under the Miller or Zuber factors.
Again, I prefaced my argument, my question with, it may be an enlightened argument, but there is a policy choice that has been made by the legislature. One point of clarification, I want to make sure I have my facts correct. Wasn't the time between the second and the third offense 3 weeks? It was February 1st, and then the third indictment was February 21st?
The second offense was February 1st, and the third offense was February 21st.
Okay, thank you.
Within 3 weeks.
So, Ms. Wolf, can you
go ahead, please.
Can you clarify what is your argument with regard to strikes under to counting as predicates convictions for offenses that were committed when a defendant is under the age of 26. I thought there was some argument in your briefing with regard to that particular line, and there was some advocacy with regard to not counting those convictions under the age of 26.
So our argument today is that any strike, that it should not be considered a strike if it occurred prior to the age of 18, which is the line that we have drawn for many different reasons. I'm not saying that at some point it might not be advocated for a different line to be drawn, but today the line that we are talking about is offenses that occurred under 18. And our argument is that any offense that occurred under the age of 18, which is under our law the jurisdictional age for adulthood, should not be considered as a strike. I bring up the argument about adolescent behavior and the developmental science being relevant until the age of 26, because I think in this case particular, it makes it even more troublesome that these cases are being counted against him. And when we talk about the purpose, the legislature's purpose in imposing repetitive schemes such as a three strikes law, and the purpose such as incapacitation, it makes it even more questionable, because in a case like this where you have an offense that happened before 18 and then two other offenses that were still under that developmental age of adulthood, it calls into question all the purposes that we tend to think of as requiring incapacitation.
You brought up 26 in your argument, the age of 26. And I want to, obviously, we have a case today involving someone who was under 18, and it's a case involving the three strikes law. But what I'm hearing from you is, although it's not before the court today, you know, we have to consider the implications of any ruling this court makes, that there really is no distinction, principal distinction, between this and another recidivist statute such as the Graves Act. Am I right? That's your position on behalf of your client?
Well, our position is today is that under the current case law, there is a distinction because this case involves life without parole.
Right, but the constitutional position, I understand the current case law, you are pressing for a change in the current expansion of the constitutional right under the New Jersey Constitution. And as I am hearing it and having read your brief, what I see here, I believe, is an argument that could apply to the next case, next term or whenever it may appear, that deals with the Graves Act or another recidivist statute. Am I right about that?
You're not wrong that at some point.
Not wrong really generally means right. So, okay. So let's stay with that for a moment. And then we see an argument in your brief that the age of 26 should be a line of demarcation. I understand you're sticking to the facts here. He was under 18, Mr. Ryan. But what I think I'm hearing is the potential for if you were to achieve the ruling you're looking for here, to expand that to every recidivist statute, and also to expand that to any offense committed under the age of 26, or maybe when the person is 26. I'm not sure how that works. But whatever it may be, we are, at that point, 8 years beyond the age of majority that the legislature's recognized. Is that a position that would naturally flow from the position you're taking in this case and the ruling you're hoping to see from this court?
Justice Patterson, I don't know that it would naturally flow from the argument we're making today, which is very centered on the mandatory nature of a life without parole.
Right,
I understand
right.
But you, but, what you're but, suggesting.
But your brief is a reach, and I'm not saying I'm you know, I understand you're advocating for an amicus, and what I'm trying to see is where is the line that could be drawn, and I think what you're arguing is there really is no principled line. If you were to prevail in what you're looking for here, that would not extend to other recidivist statutes and would not extend to individuals who were not juveniles at all under the legislature's characterization of juveniles, but were under 26 at the time of offense number 1, 2, or 3.
I think the answer to that is that our understanding of what line should be drawn has been evolving for decades. In 2004, we didn't have a line for youth to not be sentenced to the death penalty.
No,
2005, our understanding changed drastically.
I understand the law, but what I'm trying to say is there does not seem to be a boundary to this until we get to the age of 26. I'm just reading your argument, and you write, you know, wrote an excellent brief. I want to understand because and. To me, that informs what is this court going to do with this case, because if, in fact, a ruling in as you're seeking in this case would then become precedent for an expansion to other recidivist statutes and an expansion to individuals who at the time of their offenses were 26 years old or 25 without a principled Eighth Amendment, you know, one of the three factors line being drawn there, then this has very, very extensive implications. And that's what I'm trying to explore here. Where would you say the line has to be, may be drawn?
For today's purposes and for this case, the line currently exists at 18 for the age of jurisdiction into adult court. That could change in the future based on evolving standards. It could change based on what happens around the country. But for today's purpose, that is a clear line right now. There is a line at 18. And that line does not require a large leap from this court's decision, Zuber, to get to the case today, which is that a predicate offense that happens under 18 cannot be used to later impose a mandatory life without parole sentence. That offense is the bedrock of the later sentence that is being imposed. It's not like other statutes where they're considering juvenile adjudications, which might be problematic in their own right, but right now are constitutional. This is not that case. This is a predicate offense that, but for its occurrence at the age of 16, could not have led to the decision, the mandatory decision that took all youth out of consideration by the trial court to impose a mandatory sentence of life without parole.
So in this very, very defendant's case, that argument could also serve to seek a resentencing for his Graves Act offense, for his extended term under the Graves Act. Is that right?
I don't believe so today. Not under the argument today.
The next case.
Under the argument we're making, this would not call into question the Graves Act, the imposition of the Graves Act, nor do we brief that today, obviously. But under the argument we're making today, we are specifically limiting it to the imposition of life without parole, which is flows naturally from the Supreme Court cases, or the equivalent of life without parole, which flows from this court's recent decision in Zuber. So today, we're not arguing about what else could happen if he was subject to other repetitive schemes. I know that counsel mentioned the Persistent Offender Act, which ironically he would not have even been eligible for. And that actually goes to the point about penological purpose. If the purpose is to impose graduated sentences such that an offender is on notice and is deterred from committing future crimes, we have several things here that are counting against that being a purpose here. First of all, we know that youth are not deterred in the same way that adults are. But also, he was not even eligible for those graduated sentences that would have resulted in lengthier terms before he was then subject to the mandatory sentence.
But under your argument, Ms. Wealth, if his third offense occurred when he was 40, forget that he got a Graves Act sentence in my hypothetical, he would not be eligible for the three strikes sentencing if we were to adopt your approach that does not allow consideration at all of the offense that was committed under age 18.
That is correct. He would not be eligible if his first offense or second offense even were committed before the age of 18 and then the subsequent offenses at 40. Certainly the facts here make it more compelling because of that developmental science, but so too in that case, using the offense that happened before he was 18, and I'll reference Justice Albin's metaphor to the uncounseled plea, right? If we look at it as if the young person was not fully developed, did not have the cognitive state that you would imagine when he was going through the process of getting getting convicted, that should not be counted as a later offense.
I recognize that.
And your contemporary standards argument is rooted not just in science, it's rooted in our law. It's rooted in multiple United States Supreme Court cases, in our own case, that says that children are different. Children are less morally culpable. Children act impulsively. And the question, so those standards are not up in the air. We've spoken about them. And the question is whether or not children are different is going to be considered for purposes of the three strikes law.
Absolutely. And the problem here, the constitutional problem here, is that not only were they not considered, they were not permitted to be considered. Because to your earlier point, as the law is written, the judge had to impose a sentence once the predicate offenses were met. And under the current version of the law, even if the third offense happened when he was under 18, he would have to impose a sentence of life without parole, which is the obvious case here. But it is still true that that's what...
Counsel, as I understand your future argument, for not the argument today, even at 26, a person is not mentally not fully cognizant and should be treated differently up to the age 26. That's what I thought you argued. Is that correct?
In our brief, we stressed that more as far as the understanding of developmental science. What we're saying today is that 18 is being used as a jurisdictional.
But in the future, you're the way you're arguing today, you're thinking of 26, based on what I hear, it would be still an age where the person would be treated as a juvenile because they're not fully, the brain's not fully developed yet?
Again, I can't predict what, you know, what the future will hold.
No, but isn't that your argument?
Our argument,
not asking to predict, that's your argument, isn't it?
Our argument is that the developmental science that forms the core of the cases that have led us to where we are today say that the science applies up until the age of 26. But under
should we apply that across the board? In other words, attorneys can usually practice around 25 years old. If an attorney comes before us on disbarment for invading a trust account at 25, that should be a consideration? That the attorney arguing, or should that be a consideration for PCRs and effective assistance of counsel, that the attorney who represented the defendant was only 25 years old? Should that be considered?
Your Honor, actually, under the current legislature's revisions in 2016, and actually more recently in 2020, there is a consideration at sentencing for mitigation under Factor 14 for under age 26. So it is becoming.
I'm not talking about the litigant, the defendant. I'm talking about the attorney. Would that be support an argument, a PCR argument, that the attorney tried the case was only 25 years old, therefore wasn't fully developed yet, and the defendant's entitled to a new trial as a result of that?
Your Honor, although the brain science might apply to that particular individual, that's not the legal basis for the case here today. The legal basis for the case here today.
I'm not asking about today. I'm asking about the argument you're making into the future, which may play into effect depending on how those opinions are written.
The opinion in this case does not need to be written to include over 18 offenses. The purpose of bringing in that science and that developmental background is to say that our understanding of youth, the youth brain, is evolving, and our understanding of what happens up until the age of 26 is that the youth brain is not fully developed. And here, for Mr. Ryan's case, looking at all of his acts together, it's helpful to have that background, but it's also of constitutional dimension for someone under 18, because that's the line that our case is and that this court has drawn to say that it's unconstitutional for a person who is under 18 to be sentenced to mandatory life without parole. And in this case, where that was used as a but-for condition of imposing that sentence, it can't stand under our current cases. And this state has always afforded greater protection in this context, most recently in Zuber, in which it extended the holding of Miller to say that virtual life sentences are also considered unconstitutional. This court has always looked further than federal standards in determining that youth matters. And that's incredibly important here in this case.
So if we're a little over the 5-minute mark, as you can imagine, is there anything you wanted to present to us?
Thank you, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, we just ask that the court reverse the appellate division and determine that any sentence under the three strikes law that is based on a predicate juvenile offense cannot stand. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. McGuire.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Being mindful of the court's docket and the thorough arguments of my colleagues, I'll keep my comments short for this morning. ACDL's position, as it was in Comer and Zarate, is that any mandatory sentencing statute that prevents a sentencing court from considering and weighing the mitigating qualities of youth, whether it's a juvenile being sentenced or an adult sentence being enhanced based upon a prior juvenile conviction, violates the Constitution. And really what our position is that discretion is the touchstone of constitutionality, that the mandatory nature of these sentences is what violates the Constitution when it prevents the court from looking at these mitigating qualities of youth. The common thread from Graham to Roper to Miller and to this court's holdings in Zuber and CK are the advances in juvenile brain science, which were discussed thoroughly just moments ago. But the Supreme Court described these facts as something that every parent knows, that kids are impetuous, they don't think things through before they do them. And to use a prior conviction for someone who is 16 and made a really bad decision does not provide a court with an opportunity to look behind what caused him to make that decision. And, you know, to answer some of the questions, it's our position that these would apply to any mandatory sentence, Graves Act, NERA, and I know that this sounds like a broad proposition, but we're really talking about a very small class of defendants, these juveniles who are waived up to adult court. And so it's not quite as broad as it sounds.
And so, you know.
But it's a constitutional challenge.
That's correct.
So, and it is a constitutional challenge, which I think you've acknowledged, and candidly, as you should, and I appreciate that, that could knock out a number of statutes that the legislature has put in place, some of them very longstanding, that have recidivist components to them.
It could. I don't know if it would knock it out. What we're asking is that they be rendered discretionary. And so a sentencing court.
But it's a constitutional challenge, and the legislature has not included that in the statute. And there is really no reading of the statute, tell me if I'm wrong, that would indicate some kind of inferred intent to exclude a juvenile offense. So primarily defendant, but you're supporting the defendant's position. You've got to overcome the very high burden and presumption of constitutionality with respect to the statute and these other potential statutes that are in the crosshairs, clearly.
I agree. It is a high burden.
So to say that ultimately there may not be many people who are affected by it is an interesting fact, but that it remains a very broad attack on the legislative determinations because it's, you know, multiple statutes are potentially.
I understand that, Justice, and it is, you know, a concern. What we're dealing with here is the court has spoken to what it views as constitutional with regard to juveniles and sentences imposed on juveniles, and the legislature has failed to act. So at a certain point, we have to look to what the basis was for those decisions, the brain science that shows children are not as morally culpable for their crimes as adults are. And in this case in particular, we're dealing with a juvenile conviction. He spent a great deal of time during his formative years in state prison, comes out of state prison, and commits two offenses in a very short time. And based upon that short period of time, he's now imprisoned at least until he's 70 years old.
So I see light in your existing between your argument and that of the prior speaker, because in emphasizing discretion in the use of prior convictions of offenses committed while a juvenile, you're allowing use of them for recidivist purposes,
sure.
Including some of our extended term statutes that are still proposing discretion in the hands of the sentencing judge.
That's what our position is, and we need to trust our sentencing judges to do what they do day in and day out and weigh these mitigating qualities of youth with the circumstances of the offense, the effect on the victim of these cases.
Your quarrel, if I may, your quarrel is not with the recidivist use of the offense. It's only with its use in a mandatory scheme such as we have.
That's correct.
In this unique setting.
That's what our position is. It's the mandatory nature of these statutes that strips our sentencing judges of any ability to be guided by these Miller factors, which have become universally accepted at this point.
I just wanted to understand your argument.
We're just dealing with a mandatory life sentence, and that's all we're dealing with. And the jurisprudence of the U.S. Supreme Court in Zuber deals with mandatory life sentences. If the juvenile conviction cannot be used as a strike, it can still be used, as Justice Levesque was discussing, discretionary for purposes of sentencing. And we know the second conviction was a 60 over 20. So we're not talking about some light sentence. The potential sentence is could still be a 30-year parole disqualifier. Am I not mistaken?
Absolutely, Justice. Yes, and that's exactly our point. Our judges, our sentencing courts, are well equipped to deal with these issues. They do it on a daily basis, and we need to trust them to apply these Miller factors and serve, you know, to borrow from the federal code, a sentence that is sufficient but not greater than necessary to achieve those penological objectives that we discussed. And if there are no further questions, we'll rely on our brief and the arguments of our co-counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Finkelstein. Thank you, Mr. McGuire. Mr. Finkelstein.
Thank you, Chief Justice Ravner, and may it please the court. I'd like to focus on three points in my opening statement, and two of them tie in well with a couple questions that have been asked from the court. So first and foremost, the reasoning of Roper, Graham, Miller, and Zuber has no place here. The central concern of those cases is that a juvenile offender could be sentenced to death or life without parole when he's not incorrigible, when he merely commits the offenses because of transient immaturity. Take Miller and Zuber. In those cases, the sentencing judge tries to ascertain whether the juvenile offender is incorrigible or whether he committed the offenses at issue because of transient immaturity. And this court has recognized that that's not easy for a sentencing judge to do. That's a very difficult thing for a sentencing judge to evaluate, because in a certain sense, the sentencing judge is trying to evaluate what the juvenile offender is going to look like as an adult. If given a potential parole eligibility period, will this juvenile offender continue to commit crimes as an adult, or will the juvenile offender reform, mature, and lead a law-abiding life? And in this case, that question has been answered unequivocally. Defendant continued to commit violent first-degree crimes as an adult, and the question of whether he was merely immature or incorrigible at the age of 16 when he first committed armed robbery has been answered here based on the clear evidence of his convictions for the crimes he committed as an adult. And this also ties in, this point ties in very well with the question from Chief Justice Rabner about incapacitation, because the key to Roper, Graham, Miller, and Zuber, to a large extent, is that principle. When the court discusses retribution, that's mostly in Roper, and that's because Roper is a death sentence case, where the court recognizes that death is different. The Eighth Amendment applies with special force to death sentence cases. And the court in Roper makes many points about juvenile offenders there in context of the potential execution of a juvenile offender, so that the juvenile offender will not be able to enter society or potentially live as an adult. In Graham, Miller, and Zuber, when the concern focuses on incapacitation, there the court is concerned with the potential that it's too difficult to analyze whether a juvenile offender, it might be very difficult to analyze whether a juvenile offender is incorrigible or merely immature. And that's the concern. So the court recognizes that incapacitation is a legitimate goal of punishment for the legislature, but the concern is that it might be difficult for the sentencing judge to ascertain whether, to the extent that principle should apply, based on an offense committed by a juvenile because of the question of incorrigibility versus immaturity. But when a defendant commits violent first-degree crimes as an adult, that question is answered unequivocally. Second, I want to focus on two aspects of defendant's arguments that are inconsistent with black-letter law. And it's established fundamental law that a sentencer may consider an adult offender's criminal history as a juvenile at sentencing. The legislature did just that. Sentencing judges do that routinely. So the legislature can consider, as a sentencer, an adult offender's criminal history as a juvenile. Defendant's argument runs counter to that. In addition, it's black-letter law that the legislature may impose mandatory penalties. Mandatory schemes are accepted under the law by the legislature for important reasons of uniformity and democratic accountability. And defendant's argument here runs counter to the legislature's right to enact mandatory penalties. I think this point also fits in very well with the Chief Justice's question about the test that this court uses for determining whether a sentence is cruel and unusual. And the court focuses on the punishment being imposed under the three-part test. The focus essentially is whether the punishment is grossly disproportionate based on potentially national consensus or other principles. But the question is whether the punishment is grossly disproportionate. And here, defendants not really making that argument at all. I don't think defendant's argument fits under the test at all, because defendant is focusing on the idea that a certain type of crime, a crime committed by a juvenile, should categorically never be considered when the legislature is imposing a mandatory penalty on an adult. But certainly the consideration of an additional crime only strengthens the argument that the sentence is not grossly disproportionate. It's certainly just additional evidence of recidivism, as some of the questions have suggested. So that to take that completely out of the equation doesn't fit well at all with the three-part test that this court has recognized is the appropriate test under the Constitution. And last, I want to focus on an argument that defendant has made, defendant focused on as a central argument today, is that if a juvenile offender is less culpable than an adult offender, that means that a juvenile offense can never be considered under the statute. It's sort of an equal culpability principle that is defendant's central argument here. And the first problem with this argument is that it would essentially overrule State versus Oliver, because this statute recognizes varying levels of culpability is inherent within this statute. There's murder is a predicate offense under this statute, and carjacking is a predicate offense under this statute, and they have very different levels of culpability. So the legislature here was recognizing the idea that there's going to be varying levels of culpability that's inherent in this statute, and this court affirmed the constitutionality of this statute in Oliver, and the entire idea of a three strikes law is to apply it to varying situations when there are varying levels of culpability. So unsurprisingly, there's very little legal support or precedent, if any at all, for this argument that if there's varying levels of culpability of several defendants under a statute, they can never be applied, that statute can never be applied to more than one defendant. There is no rule of law that says a statute can only be addressed at the most culpable offender, and that's it. And that, in that situation, the three strikes law could only apply to murder. And that is certainly not the way the three strikes law is adopted here and nationally as well. And importantly, this argument doesn't really address our argument or the constitutional question here. Our argument is not necessarily that defendant is equally culpable for committing a crime at 16 as perhaps an adult that has ever been sentenced under the statute or that it could ever be sentenced under the statute. We're not making the argument that defendant is perfectly equally culpable as every other defendant under the statute. Our argument is that he's sufficiently culpable, and that is the constitutional question, whether the legislature can decide that when someone commits a violent first-degree crime as a juvenile and then two violent first-degree crimes as an adult, that is a sufficient danger to the public, and that makes the defendant sufficiently culpable to warrant this mandatory penalty. And of course, protecting the public is the legislature's main goal and main aim in this statute and generally. So to conclude my opening remark, I'd ask this court to hold that the legislature, it's not cruel and unusual for the legislature to protect the public when a defendant commits a violent first-degree crime as a juvenile and then two violent first-degree crimes as an adult.
So counsel, it was black-letter law that an uncounseled predicate DWI offense could be used to count as a second or a third DWI conviction until this court said that it was fundamentally unfair to do so. So looking at our jurisprudence with respect to predicate offenses that may lack some sufficient reliability as an enhancer, why shouldn't we be considering all of our jurisprudence, U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence, Zuber, that talks about that children are different, they're not as morally culpable, a 16-year-old's brain is not fully developed. Why shouldn't we use our sort of prior jurisprudence and mesh it to constitutional jurisprudence and suggest that that predicate that may not be reliable enough for an enhancer because of the not fully developed brain and lack of moral culpability for giving a life sentence?
I have a few, and
I know you're saying everything's black letter law until this court or some other court says the Constitution places certain limits on the manner of sentencing. Go ahead.
I agree with that. Of course, something black letter law should not be set aside lightly, but I have a few responses to there are a few threads to your question, Your Honor. So first, of course, it's not uncounseled at all. So I think the analogy is not a good one to start with because of course, defendant had counsel, and so I think in terms of just looking at his uncounseled, just as a first threshold, is problematic. And I think in addition, defendant's argument is that it's cruel and unusual to consider this as a prior conviction under the statute. But of course, if you look at Graham, just for the juvenile offense alone, under Graham, defendant could have been sentenced to life with parole. So Graham recognizes life without parole as the dividing line. So there's no dispute here. Defendant could have been sentenced to a significant period of incarceration based solely on his juvenile.
So I agree with that. But do you accept the principles that are encompassed within U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence and ours that children are not as morally culpable as adults? You accept that?
Yeah, as a general principle, yes. Absolutely.
And the brain science. Undeveloped brain of a juvenile. You accept all that, don't you?
I'm not arguing against Roper, Graham, Miller, and Zuber at all. My opening remark, my first point was to focus on how those cases are fundamentally different from this case. Of course, the holdings are completely different, but then the reasoning as well.
But if we accept all that, why should that be used as a booster to get a 22-year-old, 23-year-old, to a life with, to life basically without parole, 47 years.
Because the legislature is allowed to determine that it's a serious crime, that it's a serious violent crime that can be looked at as further evidence of recidivism. And the legislature is allowed to be concerned with violent criminal conduct.
I agree, but the question for us, of course, this is mandated by the legislature, so I understand that. But the question is whether using that prior juvenile conviction to impose a sentence where this 22, 23-year-old will now serve 47 years in prison until the age of 70 is cruel and unusual under our state constitution when using a prior juvenile conviction.
I agree that's the question. I think I tried to answer, bring up a point about the Chief Justice's question about the three-part test, and I think it's because defendant's not arguing that the length of his incarceration is grossly disproportionate to this offense, to the offenses. In fact, I believe he conceded that he could be sentenced to a longer period of incarceration by a sentencing judge in the event of a resentencing, because here he would need to be sentenced for two first-degree crimes. He's seeking to essentially vacate two first-degree sentences, so you have two extended-term sentences. So defendant's not challenging the length of his sentence in a gross proportionate sense. A defendant could always bring a gross proportionate challenge under the Constitution and argue that if you take all three convictions, or you take whatever the case may be, four convictions, two convictions, it's simply grossly disproportionate to mandate the sentence that was mandated. That argument is always available in every case, and it's available to defendant here. Instead, he did not make that argument. He's asking this court to categorically forbid the legislature from including an offense committed as a juvenile in this statute, and that would apply to murder.
That will impose a life sentence, and in his case, a 47-year period of parole disqualification. And they're saying that that's grossly disproportionate, using that juvenile conviction to get to that end. That's what they're saying.
I disagree. They're arguing that you don't even make the gross disproportionate calculus because you don't look at, they're arguing you don't look at the first offense at all.
Yeah, they're not making any distinction between somebody who's sentenced under the three strikes law when they're 60 years old and somebody who's sentenced under the three strikes law for an offense when they're 23.
Exactly.
It's not a proportionality. And the fact that this is a lengthy sentence here because Mr. Ryan was 23 during his second and third offenses that under the third strikes law is just happens to be the facts of this case. But this is the argument they are raising here would apply to every single defendant whose first strike was while he was a juvenile.
That's exactly correct. And as I'd like to point out, a predicate offense under this statute is murder. So if a juvenile offender commits murder and then is given a period of parole eligibility and is given parole and commits two murders as an adult, it's not grossly disproportionate at all to be sentenced under this statute. I think everyone would agree with that. That's clearly constitutional. But defendant's argument would eliminate the consideration of the first offense as a juvenile when it's murder and where someone who commits two murders.
Counsel, do you draw a distinction along the lines of Justice Patterson's question? Suppose you have a situation where someone as a juvenile commits two offenses, serves a period of incarceration, is released, serves an extended period outside of living an ordinary life free from crime, and then at age 60 commits a third strike. Is there a constitutional challenge that could be brought to that situation?
Well, at any point, a defendant can always bring an as-applied constitutional challenge, arguing that it's grossly disproportionate to consider those crimes and to result in this sentence. I mean, the statute does have a feature in terms of the last period of incarceration. So the statute itself recognizes a certain length of time would actually eliminate the application of the statute. But to answer your Honor's question,
make the period of time closer. My concern was you have an immature young adult who commits two offenses, and then there's a substantial period during which the individual outside of the jail context does not commit crime. Is there a constitutional concern under a situation like that?
There's no constitutional violation whatsoever, and the legislature determining that when an adult commits a violent first-degree crime and also committed violent first-degree crimes as a juvenile, that warrants incapacitation. And I think that addresses Your Honor's earlier question about incapacitation, because the point of this statute is to protect the public and to prevent, as Mr. Smith mentioned, There was a heinous murder in California by a repeat offender granted parole. So the entire point of the statute is to potentially save lives and to prevent violent, continued violent crimes by recidivists. And that is a legitimate legislative goal. It's a legitimate legislative aim. And certainly the cruel and unusual punishment clause does not prohibit that.
Your adversary is not arguing that the juvenile conviction cannot be used for sentencing purposes. It may be for enhancing. They're saying the limited argument here before us is whether it could be used to impose a basically life without parole.
Well,
that's the argument. No one's saying that you can't use it. Can you use it for a life without parole?
Well, I agree, and he's conceding that a sentencing judge can consider it, and then he's arguing that the legislature can't, and the legislature can enact punishments that a sentencing judge can, and there's, of course, an exception in Miller, and that's specifically for when a juvenile offender is being sentenced, and that's because of the incorrigibility and maturity question that is not at issue when sentencing when an adult commits violent first-degree crimes. So I agree, Your Honor, but the problem is that it cuts against the idea that the legislature can enact mandatory penalties. And the reasoning, if it's just going to be based solely on the idea that this is life without parole, then this court will have to decide the question of parole eligibility at the age of 70. But aside from that, if that's the entire basis of the argument, he still needs to show why the legislature can't consider an offense, a serious violent offense, when mandating a punishment. So certainly I agree that the punishment might be different if it is life without parole than a lesser term of incarceration, but you still have to explain why, or the court potentially, or defendant would have to explain why the legislature can't consider criminal conduct when mandating.
Because their argument is it's using it as cruel and unusual. Their only argument is a constitutional argument. If they don't have a constitutional argument, then everyone has to bow to the legislature. So the question is contemporary standards of decency, whether or not this is meeting legitimate penological objectives, using a juvenile conviction to give a 70-year sentence where this defendant is going to serve 47 years without parole, when he may very well, right now, be totally rehabilitated after serving 26 years in prison.
I agree completely with the constitutional question. Roper specifically takes the death penalty off the table for juvenile offenders because Roper mentions that life without parole will be available for juvenile offenders. Graham recognizes that juvenile offenders can be sentenced to life with parole. Miller recognizes that juvenile offenders can be sentenced to life without parole. Zuber mentions a 50-year sentence as a possible sentence for a juvenile offender. So to argue that those sentences are permissible, but then if a juvenile offender is released and is given the chance to lead a law-abiding life as an adult, is given the opportunity to reform and refuses to do so and continues to commit violent first-degree crimes as an adult, that adult offender can't be sentenced to life either with or without parole, cannot be based on a persuasive explanation of those prior precedents.
Well, Mr. Finkelstein, you heard Mr. McGuire's argument that focused on discretion here. So why is it that judges should not be able to have the discretion to consider those juvenile offenses that were committed when an individual was under the age of 18, when we know that the brain science shows us that juveniles are different, those offenses are different, and using that predicate for a mandatory life sentence when we know that at the time that offense was committed, this person was different than they are when they are an adult. But using that as a predicate, why should judges not be able to use some discretion in those sentences that are predicated, three strike sentences that are predicated on, at least in part, a juvenile conviction?
So I think there are two main answers, and the first is structural separation of powers principle, that the legislature can enact mandatory penalties, and so Your Honor's questions suggest that it might be better for a sentencing judge to consider this instead of the legislature, but it doesn't forbid the legislature from considering this in the first instance. The legislature is aware of certainly the brain science and all the case law on this topic. The legislature can address this and if it wants to going forward. And certainly, the legislature can enact mandatory penalties. And the entire aim of the statute, quite frankly, as defendant's argument shows, is to take away judicial discretion because of what happened in California. If repeat offenders are granted parole and are not completely 100% rehabilitated, which is likely impossible for a sentencing judge to figure out, even assuming it is possible, that's certainly doubtful. If that happens and they're released from prison too soon, someone can get killed. And unfortunately, in California, there's a terrible, heinous murder of a 12-year-old girl, and the legislature was responding to that, and that was the legitimate, permissible fear that the legislature was trying to address, and as I mentioned.
But based on the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, our court's jurisprudence with regard to juveniles and the different nature of juvenile convictions, is there a constitutional issue that it is cruel and unusual to use those particular convictions when a defendant was under the age of 18 and a juvenile as a predicate for a mandatory life sentence?
Not at all. Not at all. Roper, Graham, Miller, and Zuber are concerned with the potential that a juvenile offender would be sentenced to death or life without parole where they're not incorrigible, when it's the result of transient immaturity. Here we know what defendant would look like as an adult if given the chance to reform, to potentially mature, and to lead a law-abiding life. And defendant's conduct is strong evidence of recidivism. It's evidence that as he got older, his violence escalated. So those concerns that are animating the Supreme Court and this court in Roper, Graham, Miller, and Zuber are not present here. Defendant's violent criminal conduct as an adult answers the question of whether the legislature can respond in a permissible fashion to protect the public.
So you're seeing an important distinction between a situation where a juvenile is sentenced and the opportunity of however many years or decades that sentence might be, the opportunity to demonstrate rehabilitation is essentially lost during that period. But you're saying in the case of Mr. Ryan, there not much time passed before he had two offenses, two serious violent offenses as a 23-year-old with obviously, I don't know what evidence might have been there at a sentencing for those or at the time, but the rehabilitation didn't happen.
That's exactly correct. And the first part of your question, Justice Patterson, is really the heart of our argument. And if you take Miller and Zuber, those cases are concerned with a life without, they don't prohibit a life without parole sentence for a juvenile offender. They're concerned with a mandatory nature of life without parole for a juvenile offender based on the potential that juvenile offender will not be, is not incorrigible and is perhaps the criminal crimes committed were the result of transient immaturity. And of course, Miller and Zuber recognize that life with parole is perfectly appropriate, or at least possible as a constitutional matter, and life without parole is permissible as a constitutional matter for a juvenile offender. So then to take that offense completely off the table when a juvenile offender is given the chance to reform, which Miller and Zuber essentially contemplate that sentencing judges might want to consider that there should potentially be an opportunity for a juvenile offender to show maturity, to show rehabilitation, exactly as your question suggested, Justice Patterson, that is the heart of Miller and Zuber. And when a juvenile offender is given that opportunity, proceeds to commit violent first-degree crimes as an adult with an escalating level of violence, those concerns completely fall away.
How does that fit in with the third factor for whether the punishment goes beyond what is necessary to accomplish any legitimate penological objective?
That factor cannot possibly be satisfied here, Justice Patterson. Incapacitation is a legitimate goal. Roper is the first of these four major cases on this subject, and Roper is specifically addressing retribution. Roper doesn't address incapacitation whatsoever because Roper is a death penalty case, and the court is understandably quite concerned, extremely concerned about death sentences. So the court is talking about retribution, which is completely different than incapacitation. When you go to Graham, Miller, and Zuber, the court recognizes incapacitation as a legitimate goal, and is not prohibiting legislatures or sentencing judges from imposing significant periods of incarceration on juvenile offenders simply for what they do as a juvenile. So those courts recognize that the legislature can take significant action to protect the public, just based on conduct that a juvenile criminal conduct of a juvenile. And then when you add, of course, criminal conduct by an adult, violent first-degree crimes as an adult, that certainly strengthens the argument that there is no grossly disproportionate punishment here, and that this is a legitimate interest that the legislature is certainly allowed to take to protect the public and to prevent serious violent crimes from happening again from recidivists who have continued to demonstrate that that is a repeat behavior. And this, of course, was to prevent what happened in California, violent murders by repeat offenders granted parole.
So legitimate penological objective, 47, with the use of the juvenile conviction, 47 years? That legitimate penological objective. So what is that? Like, in terms of how long you need to incapacitate this 23-year-old with the use of a prior juvenile conviction?
Well, that question, Justice Albin, cuts directly to what the U.S. Supreme Court says over and over about not trying to figure out what the perfect line is for the legislature. The U.S. Supreme Court repeatedly tries to use objective indications of how long of a sentence is too long. It's very difficult for the legislature, for judges, to figure out a perfect sentence in terms of...
I agree. 47, 67 years? At some point, the line is drawn, correct? Otherwise, we wouldn't even have cruel and unusual jurisprudence. The line is drawn somewhere. Yes?
Yes. Well, for term of years, in this case, if it was life without parole, it probably wouldn't affect the analysis, and defendants arguing that it's life without parole. So the length of this sentence is not, if you look at what the U.S. Supreme Court has said over and over, is to look at objective factors. And the U.S. Supreme Court has rarely, if ever, overturned a sentence based on the length of the term of years. And certainly when it's violent first-degree crimes on a repetitive basis, the length that the legislature chooses, as far as 47 years, to second-guess that, to be quite honest, if this was just a regular appeal in terms of the regular standard of review, abuse of discretion, shocking the judicial conscience, that standard wouldn't be satisfied here by the defendant. If you actually look at the three violent first-degree crimes that defendant committed as an adult, he received concurrent sentences, in essence, for all of them. So to look at this as just one sentence might be a little bit misleading, because he received three sentences, as Your Honor mentioned, I believe, before, about he received a 60-year sentence with 20 years of parole ineligibility for the first crime he committed as an adult, first armed robbery he committed as an adult. Then he committed another armed robbery and attempted murder.
I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not in any way diminishing the nature or the violence of these offenses, okay? They're serious offenses.
Of course.
The only question is whether or not the use of the juvenile conviction for purposes of our cruel and unusual punishment statute can be used to impose a mandatory life sentence. That's all.
Of course, and it is problematic to separate the questions, and I think this is what I want to address with the Chief Justice's question, that the three-part test doesn't even pertain to defendant's argument. Defendants are asking for a categorical rule forever eliminating the legislature's ability to impose a sentence on an adult if that offender also committed a violent crime as a juvenile, and there is no support in Roper, Graham, Miller, and Zuber or under the Constitution for that.
The nature of the application that's being made here really makes the individual sentence and how it plays out irrelevant to that three-part test. Am I wrong about that?
I think that's exactly right, and I think a great way to look at it is look at the statute, because this is a categorical challenge. So if you have murder under the statute, no one would dispute that a 47-year period for two murders as an adult is not cruel and unusual. And then if you add a third murder as a juvenile, so if you have a murder as a juvenile and two as an adult, no one would argue that 47 years shocks the conscience or is cruel and unusual. So the length of the period is essentially irrelevant in an important way, and that's why this argument here does not fit under the court's three-part test at all, because defendant
has... an application that they made specifically, an as-applied challenge to this, I assume, and that's not what was being made here. They're talking about striking down this statute as it applies to three murders,
exactly.
Including murders spread out over the course of someone's life, right?
That's exactly correct, and that's why my answer to Justice Albin's question earlier about the length of incarceration is essentially not the focus of defendant's argument, because in that case, for the defendant's second murder, the defendant in that case could receive a life sentence.
You're using these murder examples, we know that if for a murder conviction, you're going to get a life sentence for the first murder. It's not like you're going to be getting out to do a second and a third.
No, that's not correct, because this court recognizes in Miller and Zuber that if a juvenile offender is sentenced, these factors should be taken into account, and the sentencing judge should consider a period of parole eligibility. That's the idea of Miller, that there's potentially The idea that the defendant will just be immature.
You're throwing around these murder convictions as though someone's going to get out in 2 years, commit another murder, and then commit another murder. And you know that that is just not a hypothetical that has any grounding in reality.
I'm responding to the defendant's argument, which is a categorical challenge based on every, it doesn't have to be three murders. Of course, I agree with Your Honor. If you have an armed robbery as a juvenile, an armed robbery as an adult, and then the third, there's no reason this third offense could not have been a murder, Justice Salmon.
But the three strikes law could make the difference in this case between an 18-year-old getting a 30-year minimum for murder and being out at 48 versus a much longer sentence.
That's exactly correct. And the difference between attempted murder and murder is often a few inches in one direction, up, right, left, or down. It's often, there's a lot of arbitrary, random, essentially luck between attempted murder and murder. There's a timely ambulance. So the idea that this couldn't have been a murder for defendant's final offense as an adult, that's completely wrong. That this could have been a murder here, and defendant's argument would be the same if he committed murder as an adult, because he's seeking to categorically forbid the legislature from considering criminal conduct as a juvenile when that offender is given the opportunity to live a law-abiding life as an adult and proceeds.
Not categorically. I don't think anyone's arguing categorically. It can be used. The only question is, can it be used as a third strike for a life sentence? Not that it can't be used as a sentence enhancer.
Well, but the question, as some of the questions earlier from the court recognized, is what is the limiting principle and how far will this go? Will this apply to other statutes? And quite frankly, will it apply to waiver completely? I think defendant's argument here is that juveniles should always be considered different if there's a juvenile offense from an adult offense. The entire idea of waiver is not being challenged here, but the logic of it doesn't coincide well with the logic where if a defendant can be waived and convicted as an adult for offense committed as a juvenile, and Roper recognizes life without parole as an acceptable sentence, Graham recognizes life with parole, Miller recognizes life without parole for a juvenile offender, and Zuber recognizes a 50-year sentence as a permissible sentence for a juvenile offender. So to turn around and say when the adult continues to commit violent first-degree crimes, the legislature has to, in the words of the 11th Circuit, wipe the records clean of that offender on his or her 18th birthday, that's not supported by Roper, Graham, Miller, or Zuber.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add in closing?
No, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Finkelstein. Mr. Smith, brief rebuttal.
I'd like to just address a couple of matters very briefly relating to constitutionality. First of all, there was a question by a member of the court about a presumption of constitutionality.
Try to raise your voice a little bit.
I'm sorry. Regarding the question relating to the presumption of constitutionality, I think that whatever opinion that this court may render, it's going to have to acknowledge that on its face, the three strikes law would be unconstitutional as applied to a juvenile. That, you know, the strike would, as I mentioned before, would allow a juvenile to receive life without parole based on crimes committed prior to age 18.
But that's not the case in front of us, is it?
No, it's not the case.
You're talking about all three strikes take place before 18.
Right. But I think you're going to have to acknowledge that there are, in fact, problems with the statute, in your opinion.
Well, now, why do we have to acknowledge that when that's not the case in front of us? This individual was sentenced as an adult for a crime he committed as an adult.
Well,
that's not a case in front of us. Somebody may decide to mention it, but that's not the case in front of it. Why in the world do we have to deal with that?
Well, okay. Not necessarily mandated that you would have to discuss it, but the fact is that
you would like us to.
This court has spoken very clearly in State versus Zuber about sentences imposed upon
the court.
May
say that if that's the case in front of us.
Well,
that's not the case in front of us. In front of us is somebody who committed two first degree crimes as an adult. That's what's in front of us.
Okay, well, obviously, Your Honors can phrase this whatever way you choose in your opinion. I don't get to decide that. Now, however, in determining the constitutionality of a recidivist statute, the court must always consider the nature of the prior offenses. In Solem versus Helm, for example, the Supreme Court of the United States dealt with a habitual offender statute and found it to be cruel and unusual punishment, In the opinion, the court recognized that the defendant, in fact, had 6 prior convictions, but they were all for various minor offenses. Now, if I understood the Attorney General correctly, he said that he was not arguing that prior offenses committed as a juvenile had the same moral culpability as crimes committed by an adult. And that, of course, is exactly our argument in this case. That, for example, in State versus Oliver, this court found that the 3-strike statute was not cruel and unusual because it only encompassed crimes that were very serious. There's part of the opinion where they talk about, well, we're not talking about passing bad checks. But our argument here is that recognizing the fact that crimes committed as a juvenile are less morally culpable than those committed as an adult, that is a reason why the statute is unconstitutional. And the fact, of course, is that recognizing that these prior crimes have less moral culpability, the fact is that in sentencing a defendant, an adult offendant, under the 3-strikes law, the judge has no ability to consider that lessened moral culpability.
But for the defendant who is appearing in front of the sentencing judge here, yes, he had a prior juvenile offense at the age of 16, a first-degree armed robbery, but the defendant in front of the judge here was an adult being sentenced as an adult for a 3rd first-degree robbery, correct?
That's correct. And in any other context, the judge would be able to consider the fact that the person was a juvenile at the time of the first crime. In fact, now under the new mitigating factor enacted by the legislature, factor 14, the judge would have to consider the fact that the person was under age 26 at the time.
They would, but the legislature didn't say that, and didn't say that here, and didn't say that when they proposed that mitigating factor. The legislature didn't do that here.
No, that's true, but in enacting the 3-strikes law, the legislature didn't say anything. They didn't say that this is going to encompass.
Are you arguing there's an ambiguity in this law?
Well, the question that was raised, I think, by the Attorney General was that this was a legislative policy that juvenile offenders should be treated no different than adult.
I didn't hear him say that, but are you arguing there's an ambiguity in the statute?
I'm saying that it's not clear that the legislature intended this statute to apply to juveniles in terms of what constitutes the first and second
strike.
I'm
just asking the simple question. Are you claiming there's an ambiguity in the statute?
Well, yes, I'm claiming there's ambiguity in the sense that it doesn't specify, as does
the position offender. Is that what you're relying on for your argument?
Excuse me?
Is that what you're relying on for your argument?
It is part of my argument, yes.
Mr. Smith, I think we've covered this point, first round.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you to all counsel for the very helpful arguments. We will